So hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Deep Dive with Tiffany and myself, Stephen. And today we are sinking our teeth into the budget because Prime Minister Lawrence Wong just gave it, announced a whole bunch of goodies, right?
Yep. Anything stood out for you?
I don't know, a lot of talk about AI, so that was quite interesting. Mm. And of course, well, more CDC vouchers. Who doesn't like that, right?
I think the one thing that stood out to me was that the merger between Skills Future and Workforce Singapore.
Mm.
I felt that that was a bit of a long time coming. But we can get into it a little bit more later on.
Well, let's do just that because we do have a lot to talk about. And with us today, we have Associate Professor Walter Tissera from the Singapore University of Social Sciences.
Hey, good to be here.
And Dr. Ruben Ng from the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy.
Great to be here.
So, gentlemen, I think we are all of the consensus that the budget speech really leaned heavily on jobs. So jobs was kind of like the thread that was running through the entire speech. Was there something that really stood out to you guys? Maybe we'll start with you, Ruben.
It was interesting how he started. So last year he started geopolitics, this year geopolitics. But last year he went straight into individuals and cost of living. This year he went straight into companies and what we can do to make them resilient, right? So that's really expecting that there may be some downsides. So how can we put buffers in place to help companies especially bounce back and not lay off workers?
Mm. Walter?
Yeah, for me, I think it was about getting ahead of the curve because I think a lot of the speech was about trying to lay out what are the risks and the opportunities that Singapore faces, right? I mean, this is a change world. Okay, to be fair, I do feel like the government tries to make that point every single year, you have a change world crisis kind of thing. Yeah. But I think this year it bites a bit deeper than it usually does. And I think that's where all these initiatives to really lean hard into AI are coming up because I think what we've been seeing in the last year actually is that, you know, when you look at one set of numbers, the numbers for GDP growth, for jobs and so on, things look okay, you know, like people's incomes are improving, what's there to complain about? But when you go and talk to people on the street, there is this huge disconnect because very few people are sitting pretty. Lots of people are thinking, what's going to happen to my job? Can my kid find a job when they graduate from university?
Yeah.
So it was necessary for the government to get ahead of this uncertainty and unhappiness and, you know, say, okay, we've got a plan, lots of things we're going to do about it, let's see what happens, you know? So I think that's how you think about the budget this year.
And to be fair, that should be the way the government looks. I mean, we know the world keeps changing. In fact, the last few months have been pretty volatile and people are seeing all the things that are happening and therefore there is concern, there is worry. So this whole concept of jumping on the AI bandwagon, I mean, we've been pushing it for a while. We said we would, but now we're really going to focus on it with even a council set up for it. But really, I mean, who is this going to hit the most? Because are we talking about the young ones, the older ones? Is it relevant to everyone?
So actually, I think it is relevant to everybody. And I think the reason why it needs to be relevant to everyone is that there's actually already a group out there for which all of this is old news. And those are the early adopters, right? So the early adopters, whether they're in large companies or whether they're tech-savvy people or whatever, look, for the last couple of years, they've already been buying the premium AI subscriptions. They've already been rolling it into their workflows. Mm-hmm. They've already been telling people, you know what, I think I don't need to hire an intern this year. I don't need to hire this person. You know, they've been doing all this. And I think the real danger is that if we leave it just only up to the early adopters, what's going to happen is once you reach a certain scale, the ones who are lagging behind, it's as if the ladder has been pulled up before they can climb on it, right? And they cannot get on the ladder and then they can't get a job. And then, you know, we can't depend on the generosity of the early adopters to share all of this knowledge and so on with the rest. So I do see this in a way as the government trying to get in there and intervene in the market and say we need to spread the knowledge more. We need to encourage early adopters to spread the business practices. We need to learn what's going on and try to implement it more broadly. Because only then it's actually going to work. Yeah.
So this is really a push more for those who have not really adopted AI and to give them a reason, make it more accessible and say, hey, you know, let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, this I think it works not just for individuals, but also for companies, right? So AI is really front and center. We have been spending a lot of time, effort and money and leadership, right, on AI. In fact, Singapore is one of the earliest countries that sort of appointed a chief AI officer. And now with this national council, PM himself is leading it. So because of all these investments, the question is, what is my ROI, right? What's my return on investment? So the return on investment has to be companies finding productivity from implementing AI. there was a lot of focus on implementation of AI. He talked about Harris and, you know, so he needs to make these examples come alive so that people can see, okay, it's worked for other companies. Maybe it could work for me. And these are the schemes to do so, to either decrease cost, increase revenue in an uncertain world.
So do you think that this is just the first step in getting more employers on the bandwagon as well? Because it feels like 6 months. If I'm the worker, I feel like 6 months is not enough. I want something that's a little bit more long-term, a bit more sustainable. And that's something that, can the government keep sustaining this, you know, rather, or should companies, you know, jump on this and say, okay, then now we will continue with, you know, that premium.
You see, the other word that came out quite often was transition, right? So actually, no, to be honest, nobody quite knows what is going to happen in this transition. And companies themselves need to figure out, how is AI going to work for them? That's why they're taking a sectoral focus, right? I think starting from accountancy to law. So I think it's giving the tools so that companies could change their mindset to say, look, this is, we cannot just look at the risk of this, but maybe also the opportunities, but they need time to try it out. Unless they try out, they won't know what will work, what doesn't work for them. I think they're trying to find this try out during this transition period.
And that's tough, because at the same time, while we want to embrace technology, many people are fearful of it. And they, as we've just pointed out, it is taking away some jobs, you know. So, and PM has said it's not meant to come at the expense of workers, but inevitably it will come at the expense of some workers. So how do we sort of, you know, calibrate that?
Yeah, so that's where I think there are two things to think about. One is the policies that we're using to try to get AI out into the field, into the firms, right? And I think what is going to be important about this phase of policies is that, as far as possible, we have to tie the grants and incentives for implementation of AI to actually improving the quality of work, the quality of jobs. So I don't think it can be about, I'm going to give the company a check and they use that money and they buy some AI solution and they fire half their workforce, right? I think it really has to be, you're going to buy the solution, but you're also going to buy the training services, on the job training and so on, to get your workers how to use it productively. And then that's how we assess the success of it. And that's the other part of the puzzle, which is, what are the systems we put into place to help workers manage this transition? And I think here, it comes back to what I mentioned earlier, which is that on-the-job training and adaptation is really going to be the most important thing, because the workers already have this deep reservoir of skills and experience of the job. It's just that they need to adapt it to a new workflow using technology. But we want to make the best of their intuition and experience with being more productive with technology. What we do not want is that they lose their jobs and then we reskill and retrain, because unfortunately that is a very mixed record, reskilling and retraining. It's a moving target, right? What is the next thing to retrain to?
Exactly.
And that leads to a lot of unhappiness compared to adaptation.
So what can this new AI council that, you know, Prime Minister Lawrence Wong is going to chair, what will they, you know, be looking into?
I don't know what they will be doing, but I think if I were in the AI Council or were, you know, interested in that, I think the most important thing is to actually develop that body of knowledge about use cases in our context, in our industries and firms. You want to be looking, I think, for the leading firms which are already doing it. You want to understand how they're doing it, how they've improved productivity, what were the steps they took to get their stuff onboarded, and then you want to understand, how can I scale this down to the level of firms with much less organizational resources, human capital resources, than the leading firms? Because that's where it has to go eventually in the end. And I, you know, if there's a council and there are representatives from the big firms and, you know, institutions of higher learning and so on, that you really want to get them on board to say, you need to help out, because true, you're going to, you already have a head start, you know, you're already using this productively, but we need you to help out to uplift the rest of, you know, society and the workforce along with it as well.
But why make this a national agenda? Because if I compare with countries like, let's say, the United States, right? I mean, Silicon Valley is full of people who are like that. You know, they are innovators. And then people look at that and they see it as, you know, inspirational. Right. And then they move along with that. So the private sector drives that. So in this case, why do we make it, you know, so,
why,
I guess,
the government driving it?
Yeah, like, so, and so prescriptive, like, this has to happen, we need to have a council, and then we need to have this. Yeah.
It just feels like AI is no longer seen as flavor of the year. AI is here to stay, right? So there's a saying that it's not an era of change, but a change of era. So because of that, you know, AI now needs to be whole of society, whole of government. That's why the Prime Minister himself is taking that leadership. I think, to be honest, there's a lot of AI anxiety. So I think the council is strategic, but there's also a psychological dimension to it. To say, look, we got you at the highest level. Let's try to figure this out together. Again, you know, bring it back to the We First Society. Then he talked about, let's not be spectators, you know, let's work on this together. I think that's what they're trying to get with this.
Yeah, so we're really putting it on the agenda and saying this will be a priority and we're going to look at it. And it's not just something that if it happens and if it does well, you know, but we're going to put it on our radar. So let's move on and talk about, you know, the workforce, because that's another, jobs are always a concern. And we had Workforce Singapore and Skills Future being the one where we can tap into, you know, get money to sign up for courses. They will be merged into a new stat board. Well, many are saying, well, it's about time. You know, I mean...
Yeah, so I think the merger is really about trying to solve this problem that for most Singaporeans, training is a means to an end, right? I mean, of course, we do have many Singaporeans who train for personal interest and fulfillment and so on, but the end a lot of us care about is, can I get a good job with that, right? Mm. And I think this merger is a bit about trying to bridge that gap between, on the one hand, training which may be perceived to be not sufficiently practical or applicable to jobs, and on the other hand, you have got employers and work processes out there who need skilled workers and they don't know where to get them from and they don't know how to implement the training system to necessarily get them. Mm-hmm. So I think it's about trying to bridge the gap between that. I think from the user perspective, that is the Singaporean looking for training, it will be crucial, I think, in this to really improve the ability of the system to help to match workers with good, realistic training options, to give them more information about the outcomes or prospects from training, to really, you know, strengthen the link between the training and the end that I care about, which is the better job mobility and so on.
But I always thought that they were kind of talking to one another. So if I go for, like, you know, Skills Future upgrading, I was under the impression, or maybe I was sold the idea, that the people on the workforce side will acknowledge that and they will see that and they will match me with jobs.
So I think this is complicated by the fact that there are two agencies, right? Mm. So there may be some duplicative, you know, sort of activities. So I think this part of this integration approach, hopefully do some sort of last mile nudging. To say Skills Future Credit is not just for upskilling. It's upskilling for you to get an adjacent job or to get a job, you see. That's where WSG comes in. So I think it's really to tighten the value chain and to make it as seamless as possible.
So it goes back to what Walter was saying about how, I guess, you kind of don't know the end goal, because I sign up for this course, but it's not like, oh, if I sign up for ABC course in this, therefore I will get an internship at this company and therefore it will lead to a full-time job at this other company. None of that is promised down the line, right? So you end up taking a course and then you end up spending another 6 months still looking for a job. And then people will say, well, actually, maybe I should have taken another course.
Yeah, I would say that kind of promise is only integrated into a subset of our skills training, because we have had much more structured skills training, which works hand in hand with industry, which pre-identifies industry jobs and roles, has a structured training regimen, and also pre-selects the workers to go for such conversion, right? But that is a minority. And actually, one of the issues, of course, is that with such specific programs, you're actually just shifting the locus of where you make a decision on people down to the skills training end, right? So instead of deciding to interview people and hire them, you're deciding, do I like this person enough to admit them into the training program? Mm. So it's kind of narrow by necessity. Whereas I think the Skills Future Credit training has been much more broad-based. And because it's broad-based, we want as many Singaporeans who are interested to take it. But that also means that we just can't put into place a funnel or a checking system or something to make it so, you know, discriminatory that once you graduate from it, you're definitely 100% qualified for an amazing job.
It's just.
Where do you put the funnel?
Yeah, we spoke about this on an episode about the Skills Future credits as well. And I think there was this, you know, there's two schools of thought, right? That if you use the credits, it translates to a good job. But then on the other hand, we also want people to use the credit so that they can enjoy learning. So that in general, we progress as a country that, you know, I have my interests, but now putting them together into a stat board is kind of sending the signal, isn't it? That you know, it is tied directly to a job. So how is that sort of helping us as a nation to just enjoy learning?
I think now it feels, with this merger, a little bit more functional. Mm. I think it's important to balance the functionality of the Skills Future Credit with just enjoying learning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe that will help, you know, streamline the process and make it a bit clearer for people who sign up, so they know that when this course, you know, if it's floor arrangement, then I know generally I'm not going to get a job just, you know, unless I'm opening my own flower shop, you know.
Yeah, then can maybe be an entrepreneur, which, yeah, which I think fits very well into our next point about local businesses. Let's talk about local businesses
manpower.
A bit.
Manpower. Oh,
yeah, manpower.
That's always
a
big hurdle for many entrepreneurs and smaller companies. And now we're seeing the S-Pass minimum salary and the Employment Pass minimum salary will increase. Work permit levies will also increase for certain sectors. So a lot of businesses will be like, are you kidding me?
Yeah,
I mean, that's what they're thinking, right?
Yeah, it's so hard to find a local workforce. So what does that mean for me now?
You know, it is this process of continual calibration that we have to carry out in the local job market. Because the problem is with our foreign employment policy, if we don't calibrate, then there's going to be a certain number of local employers who would like to take the easier way out, you might say, and then basically rely on lower cost foreign manpower to keep their costs down rather than going for productivity. So I think every year you have to calibrate it, because as Singaporeans enjoy higher skills, higher productivity, higher wages and so on, it becomes even more important to ensure that we are reserving the foreign manpower slots for people who can actually truly value add and not just replace Singaporeans at a lower price. But I think the other part of it, of course, is that we just can't calibrate only. We have to do some business transformation, or at least try to kickstart it. And I think that's where the basically the incentives to adopt AI and business transformation and so on really come into place. So the message to businesses, I think, is, you know, kind of like, we know what some of you are up to. You're just trying to find the least cost way out, but you really can't keep doing this because this is not sustainable. And here is our carrot. So can you please take up the carrot and really transform in a meaningful way?
I see. And so will this then also result in, I guess, companies maybe, you know, not hire so much, like maybe pause in terms of their hiring, because they are also, you know, at the end of the day, they're also thinking that I need to funnel some money, more money into my
labor.
Well,
I guess you would just do the math, right? If now the levy is this price, considering the whatever accommodation, the cost of bringing in this worker is...
And then I have to do AI as well.
No, no. You know, so now you would compare it to AI. If I go subscribe to this platform, I get to pay this fee and do this, which is 60% of what the guy would do.
Mm.
Is it worthwhile?
Mm. Yeah. So what does that mean for, I guess, the local workforce, like people like me?
Mm. Yeah. It's really tough, because I think, you know, we are trying to be an education hub as well. You know, we have a lot of foreign students with us, top bright foreign students around the region. And it also means that it's very hard for them to carry on their trajectory in Singapore with this higher EP cost and, S-Pass, right? So that's probably something to think about. How do we sort of balance it out so that talent can flourish, top talent can come here, right? And companies will be open to getting this top talent, because it takes a while to groom this top talent, and we want them to be groomed in Singapore. From the other angle, I think there is an encouragement to hire local workforce as well. So I think they are trying to go both ways, but I think we need sort of this overall thinking to see how we can still attract the best foreign talent in Singapore, to Singapore.
And it's not just about attracting people in. You know, Prime Minister also said we want to send our local businesses out.
Yes.
But the whole idea is that we have to thrive in this new global order, right? So we have to stay open. We have to connect internationally. So he's offering, you know, help. There were some grants that were mentioned as well. Will this be enough for our companies to take that leap? Because they always... You know, when we've had like business owners come on, they will say that, you know, it's very hard to compete with foreign businesses when they have scale. So if we are going out there into the world, is that enough for us to you know, even venture out if we are trying to grow domestically?
Yeah, so I really like what Walter said about the use cases, the case studies. Right, because unless you have seen a successful local business internationalize, it's very hard to understand what's the pathway. So yes, incentives are great, but for rubber to hit the road, I need to be given real life examples of how that can be done,
of course,
and whether SMEs can work together to go to market together. It's very hard for just one company to enter a new market, but if a band of companies from a sectorial perspective can do that, I think that's going to be very powerful.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's right. And I thought what is interesting was also the identification of which markets we're going to look at. Africa, for example, South Latin America. I thought it was very interesting because I think these could be areas where there might still be some room for Singapore companies to have a bit of a comparative advantage in terms of bringing, you know, basically the Singapore brand name along with them, which is, you know, Singaporeans know how to make a business work, know how to look for markets, know how to, you know, be productive, hopefully. So this is something we can go in there with. And these are important areas because they're not so well tapped by perhaps our competitors. And I think there's also this point that Singapore may not have the geopolitical baggage that some of our competitors do, right? So you accept foreign investments from some countries in these places. You think, does it mean I'm aligning myself with a particular global order or something like that? What does that mean? But Singapore, no, I mean, I don't think it sends that signal. So we could be, you know, we could fly in more easily perhaps than some of the other competitors.
So from what you're saying, you need somebody kind of leading the way so that it's not just one company going up, but maybe a group of a few companies going out together to that market.
It feels a bit like a coordinated effort. He mentioned opening embassies, right? Enterprise Singapore, you know, giving the grants to some of these companies. So it feels a bit coordinated.
I want to talk a bit about, you know, the thing that we always think about, which is, you know, like retirement, cost of living and different things, right? So one of the things that Prime Minister mentioned at the budget speech was the new CPF investment scheme, right? So I want to understand, why is the government now looking at investments for people with a longer runway? Like, you know, like sort of offering these kind of investments for them to use their CPF money?
What research shows is that one of the biggest causes to failure of financial investing for individuals is they trade too much. And they trade too much because they think things are going down, they sell, then they lose money. Things are going up, they buy, but they buy the peak. People are basically very bad at timing these kinds of things. So we have to put in some guardrails on this. But as for why it is in there, it is because the way CPF is today designed is that it's not really, it doesn't really make sense from the purpose of building up long-term savings. And that is because when you're saving for the long run, conventional financial theory says you should put more investments in riskier assets when you're young, when there's a higher rate of return to compensate for the risk and when you can stomach the volatility. Yeah. And then you shift to more conservative assets with lower returns at the end. Mm. Problem with CPF is it's safe, 100% safe, fairly low return all the way.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense for young workers. So that's why I think this scheme is important.
So it's not that they're projecting that one day, you know, that 4% is not going to be enough.
I feel it's a really a managed risk approach, right? We have heard that there are just so many investment scams out there. So I think that's probably at the back of their mind. If they can centralize that, you know, CPF as a sort of platform for investments. And of course, as Walter astutely mentioned, you know, younger people would like to take on more risk, more returns, right? And on the whole is to try to maybe decrease that risk of scams if they can centralize some of these investment portals within the auspices of CPF. I think it's a bit more of an offensive but also a defensive approach to this risky environment out there with regard to scams.
So it's kind of like providing people an option. Before that, you had either CPF or you go outside completely. So now there's kind of something that's in between, which allows you to earn more but have more risks, but over a longer period of time, you know, that can be a sort of amortized a bit more.
Actually, today, a lot of people also invested their CPF money privately using the CPF investment scheme. But actually, what the data showed on that is that many of the investors do not even beat the CPF risk-free rate of return, again, because they make the wrong investments or they trade in and out too much. And so this new scheme, there will have to be some guardrails, I think, put in place to prevent people from not doing themselves any favors.
We can't help it. Human beings are just greedy. We always want more, you know. We think we can outsmart the system, but... Put $10 in, leave it for 100 years. Yeah, you make lots of money.
I mean, right? Lastly, I think just to wrap up, you know, Prime Minister talked a lot about the we first approach. You know, maybe even before in the lead up to the budget, he mentioned about this. You know, as a society, we need to move towards a we first society. Based on his speech today, you know, how far do you think we will go in fostering that? You know, just based on his announcements. Well, wow, the silence.
That's a
tough question.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, what I want to think about, I think, if maybe not so much the traditional realm of social welfare spending and so on, where I think there are actually good improvements, because, for example, there was this announcement that Comlink Plus, which is aimed at helping lower-income households achieve social mobility, that will be quite significantly strengthened. All these are good things. But I think in terms of We First, if we take the thesis seriously that we're facing some kind of unprecedented change to the way we work in our economy, right, because of AI and so on, that's where I think we do need to adopt a We First approach, because I think there is this real problem that if we all think it's every man a company for himself, right, or every man mm-hmm. a woman for himself. In other words, the moment I discover a way to use AI to improve my workflow, I keep it to myself. I don't tell other people, right. You know, I wait to outcompete them and so on. I'm not sure we're going to get anywhere as a society and economy. We'll just destroy each other, right? So I think that is where the coordination comes in. Having to learn best practices from the leading firms, the use cases, and then trying to disseminate them throughout the economy, I think that would be really helpful, because there is the big danger, and I think you see this also in talk about AI, because you see that a lot of the use cases, a lot of the investment, there's a thesis out there which is that I'm going to corner the market on this and then take over everything, right? Yeah. That's what a lot of investors are trying to do, and so that would be corrosive if it were spreading at scale in Singapore, this concept.
I think a We First Society is it's a good long-term sort of strategy, right? Because unless we stay cohesive, it's very hard to navigate choppy waters. So I think he's just trying to say, don't stand on the sidelines, come and participate with us, come and co-create with us. So I think that the inherent message is we need a very long-term strategy.
Yeah.
And that long-term mission that will take us there is this We First Society. We can't we can't really stand by the wayside, and we need to be really participative. And I think the underlying message also to be participative and not be paralyzed by fear is that we can no longer have a fixed mindset. We need a growth mindset, right? So that's why there are skills features. So all these things are connecting the dots to hopefully help us reframe the future as one of opportunity rather than one of danger where we are paralyzed by fear.
Yeah, and that's a good way to sum it up, because if you look at it, it is a full circle. I mean, everything supports each other, you know, and we do have to come together as a team because if the arms and legs don't work together, the body won't function effectively, and we will not be able to brave the storms that are coming ahead, because actually nobody really knows what could happen.
Yeah.
So I think that's a nice way to sum it up.
But thank you so much for connecting the dots for us, because, you know, when I was listening to the speech, I didn't know where the dots were leading. Yeah, but it really makes sense right now. So I hope that, you know, whoever is watching or listening, you know, it is also helpful to you as well. You know, what are your thoughts about the budget?
Yeah.
Let us know. You can write to us at cnapodcasts@mediacorp.com.sg.
Yeah. And stay with us, because over on Deep Dive, we've got lots more great conversations coming up with many special guests as well in the coming weeks. So do keep watching us.